Next case is 06779, Disciplinary Counsel versus Richard Van Agapian. Wait till I call it. Mr. Weber.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'd like to save 2 minutes for rebuttal. Three issues that I plan to discuss this morning include, first, the board's conclusion that Mr. Agapian violated DR1102A4 and DR1102A6. We believe the board erred in this regard. The second issue is the sanction. If the court does find a violation of the rules, we believe that the appropriate sanction is a public reprimand. And then the third issue is the panel's unanimous dismissal of the DR2106, which is the excessive fee claim, precludes further review by this court. Let me start with the A4. The crux of this case centers upon Mr. Agapian's record keeping, the way he recorded his time in providing services for criminal cases, indigent criminal defendants. The fee bill that he submitted required him to list the services that he performed, the date that he performed those services, and the time allotted to the performance of the service. It required it in tenths of an hour, 6 minute increments. He did not do this. That's not the way he kept his record keeping. In fact, he didn't even write down all of the services that he performed for these clients on the fee bill. In some cases, he did not even submit a fee bill in the representation of these clients. And these have been stipulated to. These facts have been stipulated to.
Well, counsel, let me ask you one question that I had about the facts. All of these fee applications were for cases that would qualify for the ceiling, the maximum amount that is allocated no matter how many hours you spend on a case. Is that correct?
Well, the way it works in Cuyahoga County is there is a cap. There is a ceiling.
There's a $400 cap if it's a plea.
No, regardless of the case, regardless of the amount of time you spend
on a case. Even if you go to trial,
yes.
There's a $400 per case
cap
ceiling.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but that's what makes this case so distinguishable from Holland and Johnson, where there was no cap.
Right. I understand.
Is there any allegation that the fee bills that were submitted and paid resulted in extra money coming to your client, or is it just a matter of bookkeeping, putting the entries on certain dates when the work really actually wasn't performed?
In our view, it's bookkeeping. There is no claim for restitution in this case.
Is there any suggestion that more money was received by your client than services were performed?
I don't believe that to be the case.
There's no allegation like that.
There's no allegation in that. There's no claim for restitution. And the fact of the matter is, he performed more services than he put down.
So if the records had been amended and the dates had been corrected, there wouldn't be more than 24 hours in one given Saturday for all of the cases, and it would have been spread out Monday through Friday, for example, and we wouldn't be here.
That's correct. If he would have gone back, and what he did is he lumped his time together. And that's inaccurate. That's the record keeping, the bookkeeping issue. He would put down a certain number of hours to a task that took the steps preceded the date that was actually recorded on the fee bill. So that's what gives the perception that he's billing 27 hours in a 24-hour day. That's not the case at all.
Any suggestion that any member of the court who authorized or approved those payments were misled, that the work wasn't actually performed or the services weren't actually received by that particular client?
That's not in this record. I mean, we have the conclusion by the panel and the board that this record keeping was misleading. And I think that's how they got to the A4. But misleading in the sense that it did not accurately
misleading
reflect.
Misleading because it said that the work was done on a given day when it may have been done on a different day, but not misleading from the standpoint of trying to obtain more money from an unsuspecting jurist who authorized payment.
That's exactly right, and that's why the panel unanimously dismissed the excessive or illegal fee allegation. If they believed that this was an attempt to gain more money, that claim would not have been unanimously dismissed. That's the padding, that's the overcharging that we see in Holland and Johnson. That's just the opposite here.
No claim of padding here.
I'll defer to disciplinary counsel's review of that, but in our mind, there have been no claim that he has been paid more than what he has done on the case.
On the case, isn't that precisely the problem? Is that on some cases, I took it from the briefs, that on some cases he apparently charged more than the time would justify. But if you take all the cases that he worked on, net-wise, the net is that he did not overcharge. These are public funds. I mean, there was a comment made as a board report or whatever that no clients were affected. Well, these are public funds that are he's being paid with, and so we have that concern to be concerned with, I think. But isn't that the problem here, that on if you take case by case, we'll find some cases, or the board found some cases, it seemed to me, that the panel in which he had overcharge on that case. But if you take all the cases, you lump them all together over a period of time, he was paid perhaps less than he could have been paid if he kept his records properly.
Well, if that's the conclusion that the board drew, they don't outline which case the overcharge occurred.
Well, no, there's this question, of course, to Mr. Coghlan, and he says that's the problem. We can't tell.
And therein lies the issue as to burden of proof, which goes to my point about the A4. The burden of proof is to show by clear and convincing evidence intent. And this disciplinary counsel failed to do. When you look at, and I take issue with disciplinary counsel's point in the brief that motive is relevant in determining sanction, not whether there's been misconduct. We disagree with that. Motive is relevant for an A4. When you look at, by definition, fraud, deceit, dishonesty, misrepresentation, those require intent. In the Hutchins case, which is cited by ODC, the court even uses the phrase requisite intent. And it makes sense, because with an A4, it carries a presumption of actual time off. So that's why that element is necessary to prove. And we don't believe that disciplinary counsel met that burden in this case. What was the intent here? The intent was not to steal money to gain an advantage that you typically see in a billing case. That's what happened in Holland and Johnson. There was no cap. They put down extra hours knowing that they were going to get compensated for that. They felt justified that they ought to be able to do that, because my recollection is that they weren't able to recover for travel fees and such.
Well, counsel, just to be clear here in my mind, disciplinary counsel, the relator, has not put forth a particular case that should have only gotten, based on the fee formula of, what is it, 40 out and 50 in?
Correct.
Based on that compilation of fees, where he should have only gotten $200 for this case.
That's correct.
There is no case identified that says, you know, this case in such and such a court, this judge authorized the $400 cap, and really he only spent enough to get a $200 fee.
That's correct. That's
so
correct.
This is all based on the fact that they looked at a particular date, accumulated the hours, and said you can't work that many hours on that particular date, so there's something here that's not right.
That's right. That's what happened with the audit. When you looked at the records and you did the math, it came up to 27 or 20 on a few days, in a day. And so disciplinary counsel, as part of the audit, investigated those records and led to the filing of the disciplinary case. But when we put the evidence on, Mr. Gopian testified as the way he approaches these cases. This is a very experienced criminal lawyer up in Cleveland. And the way he approaches these cases, he approaches them the same way he does as his private paying clients, the same vigor, the same zealousness. He doesn't just get into these cases and turn a plea.
I was going to say, counsel, isn't the problem here the form that he signs is very specific, and it's suggesting that there will be contemporaneous record keeping, and it's very specific about what the attorney is certifying. And your client is using a totally different recapitulation format in his own mind, but the problem is he's signing statements to the court that suggests what he's doing is in accordance with the form, which he's not.
That is correct. The bookkeeping is inaccurate, but we have to talk about state of mind because that's important. He was not doing that to gain an advantage to gain money, like the case in Holland and Johnson. The fact of the matter is he was sloppy. You look at the system with the cap on fees in Cuyahoga County, the minimum fee in Cuyahoga County. He gets the minimum fee for just entering an appearance in a case. You look at the nature of his practice. It's a hectic, in this criminal defense world, it's a hectic practice, this particular time period. He had a very busy caseload. All of these things, in these circumstances, in this case, led to sloppy bookkeeping. There's no question about it. And he's admitted that from day one.
And in your inaccurate certification. There's nothing there that scratches out the form and says summary of or
that's
anything to reflect what he's actually doing.
That's correct. It is inaccurate. The fee bills that he submitted were inaccurate in that regard. Inaccurate also in the sense that the fee bills did not accurately reflect all the work that he was doing. He was doing a lot more things that he didn't bother to write down in the fee bill. And that's why the panel in its report, or at the close of the evidence, the panel chair says that this is just the opposite of Holland and Johnson. He was not he's turning 3 hours into one. It's just the opposite. He was actually doing himself a disservice, if you will. And it's the mindset. His mindset was, it doesn't matter how many hours I write down because it's going to be capped anyway. So that's the state of mind element.
But there's
missing.
No question, is there, Mr. Weber, that he definitely filed motions to get the necessary discovery, that he appeared with his client, and in many instances he entered pleas of guilty, took the client to the probation department, and then reappeared at sentencing, and necessarily would have, at the rate of in or out court, easily consumed $400 worth of legal time on those cases.
There's no question. There's no question that on the items that he did write down that he
almost
actually
can't handle
that
a felony
work.
Case for less than $400.
Particularly the way Mr. Agopian approaches those cases. And the panel found that testimony to be convincing and credible. You got criminal defense lawyers, some of them are younger and trying to gain experience. Here you got a guy who's absolutely the cream of the crop, 200 criminal jury trials, 18 capital cases. And he says this is how he defines himself. This is what he does. So he puts everything he's got into these cases.
What type of mitigation has been presented in the record?
The mitigation, I know my light's on, but I want to spend 1 minute and answer that question. The mitigation is, as the board found, overwhelming. No prior, no exploitative motive, as in Holland and Johnson. He's cooperated throughout. He's acknowledged his problems with the billing at the outset. Character and reputation, the character letters, the testimony from judges, colleagues was outstanding. And the service he provides to these indigent criminal defendants is a critical factor in this case. For all the reasons that I've said, he is a benefit to that system in Cuyahoga County, Northeast Ohio, given what he brings to the table and the commitment that he makes to this. He is, as the board found, he embodies many of the aspirational ideals of the practice of law. And that's what the board found after hearing the evidence in this case.
Counsel, it seems that your client believes that he's entitled to the maximum on every case because of what you've just said. In that, I'm looking at the form motions that he's filed, and it said that request for discovery is listed at 3 hours, and every form for exculpatory evidence he puts down 3 hours. And 2.5 hours for a motion requesting evidence. It sounds as though, because the fee is rather low, the maximum fee is rather low, that he believes that, you know, the maximum is, he does work that would suggest he should get the maximum in every case, and then goes back afterwards and just puts these numbers in to possibly justify the maximum fee.
It's part of that, and it's part of the way he estimates. What goes into preparing these pleadings is a solo practitioner with limited staff, no associates, no paralegals. So he's going over to court to do the filing, to hand them to the prosecutors. He's doing some revisions on them and that sort of thing. So globally, it's an estimation on his part as to typically what it would take for him to prepare such a pleading.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Weber. Mr. Calgeri.
Thank you. May it please the court, Joseph Calgeri, Assistant Disciplinary Counsel for Relator. I would like to reserve 3 minutes in rebuttal, if I may. First, I would like to address a couple of issues that were raised by this court and by Mr. Weber. First, there was a question as to whether there was any evidence in the record as to whether or not extra money was obtained as a result of the misleading billing practices engaged in by the respondent. Relator argued at the case that this may not have been Mr. Agopian's specific intent to deprive the state of Ohio of funds. But the record demonstrates that Exhibit 7, if I could just give one example, is Exhibit 7 represents three different cases. The first case in Exhibit 7 is Arthur Ball. And Arthur Ball is just one of 80 cases that the respondent handled in the six-month period. And if you look at the first page of Exhibit 7, Arthur Ball's motion for a fee that Mr. Agopian submitted, it tells the story here. Mr. Agopian was appointed on October 11, 2002 to represent Mr. Ball on a standard low-level fifth-degree felony drug case. 51 of the 80 cases were low-level felonies, and by that I mean F4s and F5s. Mr. Agopian charged 1 hour to open up the file. That's reasonable. Mr. Agopian then charged 9.6 hours to file six standard form motions that he used in every single one of the 80 cases. 9.6 hours at $40 an hour. These motions were standard form motions, one of which even contained language pertaining to death penalty cases when most of his cases were F4s and F5s. On October 25th, just 2 weeks after being appointed, there was a pretrial, and Mr. Agopian charged 1 hour for the pretrial. Well, as you see on the form in Exhibit 7, on the date of the pretrial, Mr. Ball retained private counsel. So Mr. Agopian billed 12.1 hours on this case for filing standard form motions that he testified may have only taken 2 hours, but he charged 9.6. And he did it in every single one of the 80 cases. So that right there is a misrepresentation, and it's an inflated fee bill because he testified that he doesn't spend 9.6 hours preparing and filing these motions. Furthermore, on the date that he filed the motions in the Ball case, he also filed motions for five other clients at the same time. And that's reflected in Exhibit 15. So when Mr. Agopian testified at the hearing that the way he computes the 9.6 hours is all the work that goes into preparing the standard form motion, which he testified to would be printed out in 5 minutes, he then reviews the motion. And by that review, we know by the fact that there's language in there about death penalty cases that he doesn't review the body. He simply reviews the caption and the case number to make sure it's accurate in the service page. Takes another few minutes. He then personally files the motions by himself, and he stated that it takes him 10 to 15 minutes to walk to the courthouse, maybe a half hour to get everything filed. So what Mr. Agopian would do is he would file multiple motions for multiple clients on the same day at the same time, yet he would do exactly what Holland and Johnson did. He would bill each separate client 9.6 hours. So although it's a little more apparent in Holland and Johnson how the misconduct occurred and their motive was a bit more exploitative, the facts are pretty much identical.
So in which case did he overcharge?
Well, in the Ball case is a prime example. I mean, here's a case. He opened the file. The first time he goes to court, the counsel gets new, the defendant hires new counsel. So, you know, did he spend 12.1 hours on that case? He's already testified that the motions only took 2 hours, but he charged 9.6. If you think about that, that's a difference of 7.6 hours in 80 cases. Now, I'm not saying that Mr. Agopian did not perform more services on cases than what he reported. He's a skilled practitioner, he's a competent counsel, but he blatantly misrepresented and certified to the trial court, not only on these 80 cases, he testified that he's done this for 15 years. He certified that he spent the time reflected in the motion for the fees. And that simply was false. He did not spend 9.6 hours putting together these motions. He spent 2. So in every case, at a minimum, there was a quote-unquote overcharge of 7.6 hours. Now, I would agree with this court that when you're capped at $400, it's tough to argue that Mr. Agopian collected an excessive fee, and we did not charge that. What we did charge was that Mr. Agopian charged a clearly excessive fee, and he did that because every time he certified to the court that he was working 9.6 hours by doing these motions, it was a false statement. That's the reason why the 2106 was charged. And we feel that the panel inappropriately and erroneously dismissed that case. Now, Mr. Weber made one point that this court is precluded from reviewing the 2106 dismissal because the panel stated in the board opinion that it unanimously dismissed that. We don't feel that that is an accurate argument. Under GovBar Rule 5, Section 6H, a panel can only unanimously dismiss a count or a complaint. In this case, the 2106 was simply one charge in one count of this complaint. It was a single complaint.
Since it was a unanimous dismissal by the panel, the board was unable to review.
Well, actually, Your Honor, the board was able to review it because in addition to the fact that the panel can't just dismiss a charge, it has to be either a count or a complaint, which they didn't do in this case. The panel also is required under GovBar Rule 5-6H, if you're going to issue a unanimous dismissal of a count or a complaint, you do it before you present the report to the board. In this case, the panel simply lumped together their dismissal of 2106 and the recommendations of a finding of 1102A4 and A6 and said, here you go to the board. Once the board got the entire report, they were free to look at anything. And so is this court, and that is our position. The other point that I would like to bring up that Mr. Weber made was that Mr. Agopian testified at the hearing that he simply lumped his cases together and his time together, and that's how we ended up at the over 24 hours in a given day for billing purposes. We don't dispute that that's what Mr. Agopian did. What we dispute, and that the board agreed, this isn't a case about sloppy record keeping. It's actually a case about false and misleading record keeping. It goes deeper than the 25 hours being billed in a 24-hour day. The crux of the case deals with what he was billing for the motions on a daily basis. Mr. Agopian would make $400 on these cases. Granted, that is a pittance. That's a problem with the system. The system is overburdened, it's taxed, and it's not perfect. And the system relies on attorneys like Mr. Agopian for their truth and their integrity. And he betrayed that. He did not act with integrity when he certified to the court, I hereby certify that the time I've represented in this motion is the time that I've expended on the case. It simply is not a true statement.
Counsel, let me ask you one question because I haven't seen an actual fee application here. Did the fee application that you're talking about detail time spent discussing the case with the client, doing discovery, doing research, any of those sort of things? Or is it just pretty much in court, filings and pretrials?
The form itself is pretty much, how much time do you spend in court? How much time do you spend out of court? What's the total?
Right.
What Mr. Agopian testified to was that after each case, he would take out a sheet of paper, and he would go back and he would try and remember, based on his calendar, his recollection, the dates of his motions, how much time that he spent on each task. So we actually have a record in Exhibit 8 of all the time that Mr. Agopian spent and what he did on the case. And at every single instance, he would write down that it took him, on his own sheet of paper, 3.0 hours to do two discovery motions.
And does he also then account in that very same fee application for the amount of time he spent with the client or a family member of the client? You know, is that sort of stuff accounted for as well?
At times it is and at times it isn't. There's one there are only three examples in the exhibits. Both parties stipulated these were representative examples of thousands of cases that he has handled. In one instance, Mr. Agopian testified that he doesn't record times when he's met with clients or strategized. But in the Russell case, there actually is a reflection on the on the form that he filled out of a meeting that he had with the client. And that was testified to in the record.
And the reason I ask that is because apparently Chairman Heinz of the panel characterized this as a system of shorthand by which a practitioner who's caught up in the system could, in a reasonable and honorable way, apply for a fair fee for the work. And I'm just wondering, does he incorporate, is the theory here that he's not accounting for the telephone calls, the interviews with the witnesses, the interviews with the client, maybe going to the jail if your client's, you know, hasn't made bond, et cetera, and incorporating all that and just labeling it filing a motion? And in reality, the 3 hours that is put down there is a reflection of how much time he spent. He just didn't spend it doing the motion filing. Is that what we're talking about here?
It's an excellent point, Your Honor, and I think there are times when that exact scenario happened. Mr. Agopian spent time on these cases, and he may have spent 9.6 hours doing client conferences.
And he just labels it as a filing or whatever, just because he's lazy and doesn't want to put it, you know, keep accurate records.
Right, but I think it's important. I'm not suggesting that he did this on every case, and I don't want to come across that way, because if that was the case, we would be charging something differently. The Ball case is a prime example. In that case, he did not spend 9.6 hours doing motions, and he didn't spend 9.6 hours doing anything else on the case. On the first opportunity, Mr. Ball hired retained counsel. He was done. So, I mean, it's unfair to say he did it on 80 cases, but it's not fair to say that it never happened and that he was overpaid for his services, if that's a fair answer to your question.
So, basically, the only case that you can point to that supports is the Ball case.
Right. But on the other hand, Mr. Agopian cannot appoint to any cases where he performed more services. We're not saying that he didn't. It's just not in the record. The problem with Chairman Heinz's reasoning, and I think Mr. Weber brought this up, he said he's taking 3 hours and turning it into one. He did say that, but then Mr. Coghlan explained to him that that's not what's happening. It might look what's happening, but it's not. He was billing at times. He was inflating his bills and charging various clients for the same service. And again, the overwhelming majority of cases were F4 and F5 felonies. These weren't cases, and the respondent himself testified, the F1s and the F2s were the cases that he spent more time on, and he reached his cap. He didn't testify to that, but he said that he spent more time on F1s and F2s. We can reasonably assume that those are the cases that the respondent simply reached his maximum limit instantaneously. So I think there is a bit of a difference. Did Mr. Agopian have the means and the intent that Ms. Johnson and Mr. Holland had? Maybe not, but his conduct is strikingly similar. And at the end of the day, he certified to a trial court that he spent the amount of time on the case when, in fact, it wasn't always true.
Has he ever gone back and asked for extraordinary fees for additional time spent above the cap such that he could get $500 on a $400 case or $600 on a $400 case?
I don't believe so, and I would never insinuate that Mr. Agopian was trying to gouge the system. His record keeping was misleading. There's no doubt about it. He certified those records. The only evidence we have of Mr. Agopian.
But there's no suggestion that on a $400 cap case, if he had spent additional time for whatever reason or gone to trial, He didn't try to get a fee for $1,000
on it. No. And Mr. Agopian testified that at times he didn't even submit bills, and we don't dispute that. At times he didn't. I think the crux of the argument here is when he submitted his fee bills to the court, he knew they were false. And the court was relying on the attorneys.
You mean sometimes he handled cases and he didn't submit a bill?
Yes.
Is that what you
said? Yes.
And so what we really have here is sloppy bookkeeping. He had to go back in his mind and write down the hours.
It's more of a matter of sloppy bookkeeping. And the board, who gave great credit to the respondent's mitigation, they were very impressed by the fact that the respondent approaches this work like he does his private work. Now, I don't know if he bills clients the same way, but he approaches the work with the same level of zealousness. The board stated that this conduct goes beyond sloppy and expedient, and that it's downright misleading. And further, the board stated that the respondent's conduct exposes all practitioners to a claim that lawyers are avaricious and lazy. Worse, it jeopardizes the public's confidence in a critically important aspect of the criminal justice system.
Counsel, the difference between public reprimand that the respondent is seeking and the one-year stay that the board and the panel had recommended, do you want to comment briefly on that?
Well, originally the relator asked for a six-month actual suspension. At the time, Mr. Weber was asking for a dismissal of the case. The board came back with a one-year stay suspension. We did not object to that. We feel that a public reprimand here undermines the severity of the conduct. Remember that the system is based on trust and integrity. Even though we can't prove like we did in Holland and Johnson that the respondent came into an extra $11,000 or whatever it was in the Holland case, Mr. Agopian consciously made the decision to ignore the rules, and he consciously and falsely signed a certification saying that his time accurately reflected the work he did on the case. And then he testified in court at the hearing that that wasn't true, the certification wasn't true. So we feel that it's a misrepresentation. Did he intend to deceive the system and get more money? Maybe not, but he certainly intended to misrepresent his time, and he must be held accountable for that.
Your primary concern on your objection is that we recognize 2.106, 2-106, which the board dismissed. Isn't that right, the charge?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Caligiuri. Mr. Weber, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just close by reciting what disciplinary counsel's position is. We heard today that Mr. Agopian is not trying to gouge the system. We heard at the hearing that Mr. Agopian did not intend to defraud the system. And we heard in the reply brief that there was not clear and convincing proof that respondents' actions were done with prior intent to defraud. There can be no A4. There can be no A4 because—
Mr. Weber, what cases do you find most analogous that would lead the court to be inclined to rule for a public reprimand based on our precedent?
We believe the cases that we cited to, I think the Daugherty case, where there was an A4 and an A6, and the court went with a public reprimand. Here, we don't believe there's an A4 or an A6, but that would be the case if the court were to somehow find an A4 and an A6. The Daugherty case, and there's a couple other cases that I cite to in the brief that warrant the public reprimand, given the overwhelming mitigation evidence that exists in this case.
I guess what concerns me, Mr. Weber, is there certainly you have some equities. Your client has some equities here, but the lawyer repeatedly filing affidavits or forms with the court indicating expenditure of a certain number of hours is, it may not be defrauding, but it seems to me it's the argument that we've heard now and then, well, all my other conduct has been by the rules, but this time I made a mistake, and so I want you to look at all of my other conduct as a lawyer and consider that, and whether I certainly usually in the mitigation phase, but here your argument really is that look at the conduct in which I was so-called sloppy in bookkeeping, and all, but also look at the fact that I represented clients for whom I did not receive a fee, or I did more work, performed more work than the fee that I received. That argument, if we take that argument into other cases, that's a little tricky, isn't it? I mean, a little, not a very good signal to the bar that particularly with, I guess, with the filing of the affidavits with the court really bother me here, because it wasn't just once or twice, but it was a real pattern where he was misrepresenting to the court what he was doing. And I don't know how we write an opinion that says, well, it's okay in this case because you also did some good work, and we just sort of lump it all together. We don't do that usually.
Well, it's not a matter of just doing good work. What the evidence in this case is, on these cases, there was a lot of things that he was doing that did not go on the fee bill. For example, Mr. Caligiuri talks about opening the file 1 point hour. What goes into opening the file is going over to the court, running the criminal docket, looking for prior convictions.
But I thought he admitted that he did not spend a number of hours on some of these cases, the Baker case, for example, that his form indicated he had spent. Isn't that correct or not?
No, that's not correct. On that Ball case, there was 1 hour for opening the file. The evidence in the case is 1 hour is far less than what it actually took. Going over to court, researching, running the criminal docket, doing research on sentencing, talking with the client, all of that was the 1 hour opening to file.
But 9.6 for 5 motions that you punch on a computer button, that he didn't work and he didn't do.
Well, he was preparing those motions, there's no question. There was no question about it that he was preparing those motions. He was estimating based upon the time it typically took to perform that service.
But he even testified it did not take 9.6 hours, it took 2, which probably is even exaggerating.
But when you
there
look...
There are 4 motions, you know, we all prepared them as attorneys. You punch a button on a computer anymore, you plug in the name, it doesn't even take 2 hours.
But when you look at his state of mind as to why he was doing this estimation, it was not to gain a fee. And that's, with the A4, that's what you see with that. That element is necessary. You need to act to induce somebody else so that the lawyer can gain an advantage. That doesn't exist here. Given the way Cuyahoga compensates.
If we give a public reprimand in this case, don't we send the message to all court-appointed attorneys that the record-keeping and the affidavits they sign can be sloppy and it's not going to have any penalty?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I think in any disposition of this case, this court can stress that lawyers, not only in the criminal system, but every facet of the practice, must take their record-keeping, their billing practices very seriously. There's no question about it. I do not want to minimize that or have the court look away from that in any regard, and either does Mr. Agopian. He acknowledges that that's where he fell down in this case. And in any disposition of the case, I think the court can remind the bar how important that aspect is.
Counsel, how did these infractions come to light? Were they being audited by the state because of the reimbursement?
I believe there was an audit done by the public defender, the state public defender.
Right, because of the reimbursement to the county for these fees, or partial reimbursement. And, I mean, my thoughts on this is that your client is not alone in how he keeps track of his time, that there are other attorneys out there that do this type of work who use the, quote, shorthand for and submit it, and you know, the judges review it. Now, to me, we've got a little issue maybe with the members of the judiciary taking a look at these fee applications and not questioning them.
Well, I can't speak to how the members of the judiciary, what they think when they review these, or as to what other practitioners have done. The only comment I have there is the requirement for tenths of an hour, 6-minute increments in this type of practice is difficult. It's required, but it's just difficult given the way they practice, the way they're at court on a number of cases. So it's very difficult. I think that's where the board, when they leapt to the conclusion that they're misleading because they're inaccurate as to the time actually spent. And I think it's compelling that this panel threw out the illegal or excessive fee, charging an excessive fee. That demonstrates the power and the convincingness of Mr. Agopian's testimony, the truthfulness of it.
But doesn't that distinguish it from Holland and Johnson, dismissing the excessive fee charge? I mean, Holland was several thousand dollars in excess of what should have been, wasn't it?
Absolutely. That's one of the major critical distinctions of Holland and Johnson. They correctly were found in violation of 2106, given the way—
They didn't get a public reprimand.
Pardon me?
They didn't get a public reprimand.
They got actual time off in those cases because of there were at least three disciplinary rule violations in that case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. The case is submitted. I'm sorry, Mr. Caligiuri, you have rebuttal time on your objections.
I'll be brief. Just a couple of points in response to some of the questions. Most recently, the suggestion that the panel threw out the 2106 is simply misplaced. The panel dismissed the 2106 because they felt that under the pay system, that Mr. Agopian was incapable of collecting an excessive fee. We did not charge him with collecting an excessive fee. We charged him with charging an excessive fee, and that's how the rule reads. A lawyer shall not make an agreement for to charge or collect an illegal or clearly excessive fee. By submitting his fee motions and certifying that they were accurate, saying that he spent this amount of time, 9.6 hours, on these standard form motions, where he admitted at page 55 that it only took him 2 hours. That was charging a clearly excessive fee. It should not matter whether or not he collected on the fee. The fact is he charged it.
Yes. Counsel, one question. Each fee application is separate for a separate case. Is
yes,
that how
it is.
So it may be difficult for judges, for example, to know if the same time is being charged to multiple clients.
That's correct.
Okay, thank
And that,
you.
That's exactly what happened in Holland and Johnson, too. And that's another point that I wanted to address in closing. Again, you can question why the judges, or maybe the judges, need to pay particular attention to these fee applications. There was testimony in this hearing that the system's overburdened. The courts, the clerks, they receive thousands of these fee applications. And part of the reason why the court asked the lawyers to police themselves is to ease that burden. So the court's placing trust in counsel to submit responsible, accurate, truthful statements, and Mr. Agopian has failed to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Caligiuri. The case is submitted. You obey advice of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.